Nine Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Welcome to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson in place of Chuck Price today, although no one replaces Chuck Price. But we are here in lovely downtown Portland on a gorgeous sunny day, crisp, clean fall day. Lots of activity in the city today. Don't know why. I must be getting ready for the marathon perhaps tomorrow. And today Chuck is out of town visiting. I think he's doing some education issues. So he'll be back and tell us all the great news, and we'll have a show on that. But today, we are going to be talking about a variety of topics. But before I start, we have in the studio with me Kevin Stege of the Baker Colson CPA firm.
Good morning, Carl.
My tax investigator cohort in esoteric studies.
That's correct. And I think we've got a good program for our listeners today, in spite of Chuck being gone and you say he's getting CPE, continuing education, but I have a feeling there's golf in there. There almost always is somewhere.
Well, I think that maybe that's part of the CPE. I think there's a required minimum number of hours, don't you think?
I think you're right.
I think so, yeah. Well, anyway, this is a show that is interactive, and that means that we would like to interact with you. It makes it a lot easier for us not to have to sit here and talk to ourselves all morning long, and there's no question that we will not attempt to answer. Can't guarantee the best answer always, but we will certainly make an attempt to give you some guidance or some direction or at least some commentary. And if you want to do that, you have to call us at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. So obvious kinds of questions would have to do, or if you just want to comment on our show and tell us what you like and tell us what you don't, if you have topics you'd like us to discuss, that would be fine too. And but we tend to do tax matters, we tend to do estate planning and probate matters and other kinds of legal matters, business law, business tax, and things like that, things that do come up in our various practices. That's one of the things. We are local. We actually live in this community. We work in this community. We've been here a long, long time. We're not talking to you from someplace in New Jersey or El Paso or something. And, so we know what it's like to live here. And that means that we're familiar with your issues and our issues. And hopefully that will add a little extra to the answer that we can give you. So we're going to have a show today, and we're going to kind of discuss a variety of topics. But in terms of Carl's comments, that's the time that I talk about things. The one thing I wanted to talk about was a couple of news stories that I saw, and I don't know a whole lot about it. I just want to kind of throw it out as a warning. Number one, there was a scam on elderly people where people were calling in about the Affordable Care Act and trying to extract personal information from people that they called. The Affordable Care Act people, the state of Oregon people who administer the program here in Oregon, they don't do that. So if anybody calls you up and says, I want to talk to you about, you know, qualifying for insurance under the Affordable Care Act or any other thing, and they ask you for your birthday and they ask you for your Social Security number, your bank accounts or anything, just hang up. Don't talk to those people. You should, you know, if you need that information, you call them. They shouldn't be calling you. And likewise, there's another scam similar in nature that's been going around where people have been calling about Comcast and basically saying your bill's overdue and you got to, you know, pay up now, and even though it's probably not. And so then what they do is to have you avoid these, you know, horrible consequences, they ask you for your personal information. It's atrocious that there are those people who are so callous that they would use this kind of a ploy to, you know, steal your money, but that's what they do. And truthfully, once they get your personal information, if they use it for bad effect, cleaning it up is a mess. It is really very difficult to do and very costly and very frustrating. And it's the last thing on earth anybody really needs. So the number one way to avoid that is don't give it to them. Don't give them your personal information. Obviously, there are times when we have to give personal information. For example, if you go in to have your tax return done, you know, you're going to have to give that personal information to your tax preparer. Likewise, and if you're going to have your estate planning done, you're going to have to give some of that personal information to your attorney. Actually, I try to avoid getting very much personal information of that sort just for that very reason, not because we would use it, just because, you know, if I don't need it, why should I get it?
That's right. And, you know, regarding the Affordable Care Act scam, you'll know when it's time to give the appropriate information because you will have been the one to initiate the contact with the appropriate source. And there will be some information, personal information, that is going to be required to be exchanged with the state exchange if that's the route you're going, or with your insurance agent. But that's you providing it directly with somebody you've established contact with.
Absolutely. So that's kind of Carl's comments for the morning. But one of the things we want to talk about, we have a bunch of things. First of all, we thought we might talk about a little bit about estate taxes. We think that there's some misunderstandings. And by the way, if you have any questions along those lines, please give us a call at 503-417-7626. But we want to talk about estate planning, just basically, or estate taxes, basically how it works. Not a big lecture here, so, you know, don't fall asleep again. Get your coffee up. We'll try to keep it light and understandable, and we try to tell you the stuff that's important to you, how it works, not necessarily the code sections, although Kevin, you know, really gets disappointed when we can't quote code sections. But nonetheless, that's what we're going to do. And we're going to talk about stepped-up basis. That sounds really exciting, doesn't it? But, you know, we'll shine a little light on that from the window coming in here, and hopefully that will give an idea that you can talk about with your estate planning. And we're going to talk a little bit about how wills and trusts work together and how they are different. And again, I'm not going to give you a treatise on wills and trusts because it would take us too long to do that. But I think sometimes they're misunderstood a little bit. And as part of that, we're going to talk about funding the living trust, because that is one of the fundamental issues that comes up with living trusts, is how do the assets get into the trust in the first place? And that's up to you and the lawyer who helps you draft your living trust. And so it's important to make sure that you get the right assets in, and you don't necessarily put all of your assets in a trust. A lot of times we recommend that we do, but sometimes it's not convenient, or sometimes it doesn't make sense to do that. But you do need to make sure that whatever you put in the trust and whatever you keep out of the trust, that the way that they are transferred upon your death is consistent with each other, so that it works, so that it works for the plan. And we're going to also talk a little bit about limited liability companies and corporations, and, you know, how do they work and how do they come into play with respect to your business? How do they come into play with respect to your estate planning? And if you have any questions along those lines, again, I think that there are some misunderstandings about how they work and why you would do it and why they're important to some people. And so if you have those questions, please give us a call. And then Kevin has a very interesting tax case that he wants to talk to you about when the tax investigator comes back. And so for now, I think we're going to take a little short break. And then we'll come back and we're going to start talking about those topics. And we welcome your calls. This is Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, wealth management. Price Financial Group, wealth management.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson in for Chuck Price, and our tax investigator is in the house. Kevin Stege is here, and I think that what we're going to talk about is the case of the miscreant Beanie Baby magnet.
That is right. Interestingly enough, we've talked on programs past about some of the issues related to having a foreign bank account. And I think for the most part, which one of us wouldn't want a Swiss bank account? I know every time I talk about it, your eyes brighten up over there. But, even if it was $5, you could say, I've got a Swiss bank account. But of course, it comes with a price if you are using it to hide income. And this one caught me a little off guard just because of the sheer size of it. But Ty Warner, the creator of Beanie Babies plush toys, which I'm sure you know about him because of your large collection, Carl.
Well, I was going to say, when my daughter was growing up, that was a big thing. And, they used to have like clubs and special, like you have Tupperware parties, you'd have Beanie Baby, and it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so My Little Ponies fell right in that same niche, too.
I see. And Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yeah. I miss that stuff, really.
Yeah, I did too, fortunately. So, but anyway, he squirreled away just under $100 million into a UBS account. And then he went and snuck over a little more into another account.
I hate to interrupt you, Kevin, but we'll get back to it. We have a caller on Rob. Are you with us now?
Good morning.
Good morning. The note that I have says you want to talk about Roth IRAs. We'll do our best on that one. I think Kevin's probably more knowledgeable than I am. He just grimaced. But Chuck is the guy that knows most of this stuff. Give us a shot. We'll try to help you out.
It's kind of probably a different kind of question about it. And first of all, I wanted to tell you that I enjoy listening to your show every Saturday, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to do this.
Well, thank you. We kind of like doing it. It's halfway fun for us, you know?
Great. What I'd like to know, on a Roth IRA, can a person make a contribution to another person's Roth IRA?
That would probably just be a gift in that situation. And so, I mean, the short answer is yes, you could. And since the annual gifting is, it'd probably be better just to give the, well, if you give him the money, you're not sure that person's going to put it directly into the Roth. So if the bank allows you to make a deposit into their Roth up to $5,000 or $6,000, I would say that that would probably work. And if you're under the 14, you'd probably be okay.
What we're thinking is we have an adult child, and they're both working, but with the kids, you know, they have their own kids, and they have Roth IRAs, but they don't really have the extra money to fund them, and we'd like to just give them a gift and put it in their account.
Well, I don't know how much is the limit on putting into a Roth?
It'd be $5,000 if you're under the age 50, so you could do up to $5,000 for each of them.
Okay, so that's really pretty easy in this sense, because as Kevin says, I think that's going to also be construed as a gift. You know, it's a gift to them. But as long as you stayed under $14,000 a year per person, and with you and your wife, you could give $28,000 to each child if you really wanted to and avoid any kind of gift tax issue.
Yeah. I wasn't really worried about the tax or that it was a gift. I just kind of wanted to get it into their account for them for later on in life, so they'd be a little better off.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a matter of, abundance of caution, maybe. You might give them the money and ask them to put it in. Hopefully, I would think that they would be willing to do that. I mean, it seems like free money is a pretty good deal. So,
yeah.
But I think you could do that. I think I would, if the bank will let you do it, or whoever's holding the IRA, I suppose you could do it. A lot of times they don't pay a lot of attention to the deposit sorts of things. But the other thing, I guess, would be, just to give it to the kids and have them put it in.
Yeah, we're thinking, for a Christmas gift, that kind of a deal.
Sure. So. As long as it doesn't exceed the maximum amount that you can put in there, you're fine.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Very good question, and that's a great Christmas gift, frankly.
Yes, it is. I think that beats them socks. That's
the lump of coal that I use.
Yeah, yeah. That's so. Anyway, back to the beanie baggy.
Yes,
baggy beanie.
Yes, yes. So just to make short order of this, Mr. Warner put in almost $100 million of cash into a UBS account, and then he started another account under the name of. I think it was something like Molinari Foundation or Milani Foundation. So he kind of hid it, and then he transferred the money from the first account to the second, and then it sat in there. And of course, it made pretty good interest to the tune of, $3 million or so per year. And that's what he failed to report, that income on his taxes, for many years. So, he had a shortfall of, it was about $5 million in taxes over 11 years. And, one thing that caught my attention with this also is that in 2009, he tried to avoid prosecution on this through the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program, which we've talked a little bit about in programs past, and he was denied entry into that. I thought they would accept anybody, but apparently, for some reason, they knew about him, they wanted to prosecute him, and so they did. But I think the last interesting fact is his statement to the judge was, "I'm pleading guilty because I am guilty," and that's how he started his guilty plea. And so
you don't hear that a lot.
You do not. That is a break from the normal, where people try to skirt just about every sort of responsibility. So that is our.
And how much money did he? How much money did it cost him?
That is a good question. He had $250,000 penalty, a fine for it. But then he also had to pay a civil penalty of $53 million. So over half of the value of the account is gone. So he would have been well better off just paying the tax each year and going forward.
Or giving a lot of it to charity, perhaps.
That's true. In his defense, he has given over $140 million in cash and Beanie Babies to charities over the years. So he is a charitable-minded man, and I think he is truly contrite for what he's done.
Well, I guess I'm amazed when I think about it. I shouldn't be, but just the scale of how much money was in Beanie Babies. So, clean those things up off the shelf and, put them away. Maybe they'll still be worth some money. Well, that's a great, great, case. And I really appreciate it when you get those, on a weekly basis or something that's very interesting. So let's talk just a little bit, about estate taxes and one of the things that I think comes up is that I think everybody says, ooh, they're really worried about, you know, what happens. They don't want their kids to have to, you know, pay estate tax. The basic rule here in Oregon is that, first of all, each individual can transfer at death $1 million absolutely tax-free. That's under Oregon law. And under federal law, each individual can transfer $5.25 million absolutely tax-free. So if you are under those two numbers, no matter what the asset is, with the exception of IRAs and, you know, things that have an income tax component, but, you know, all of the assets, say, for example, it involves some real property, and it involves, you know, some cash, and it's $800,000. It goes to the heirs or to the devisees under a will or a trust, absolutely tax-free. No income tax to them, no inheritance tax to them, and it's just a good deal. Even better is the concept of stepped-up basis. So let's, using my example of $800,000 in real property, let's suppose, now that's the fair market value. So if Kevin was my son, which he could be, I guess, and I gave him enough, and if I had $800,000 in real property, which I don't, and I died, which I could, and I gave it to Kevin, and, the next day he turned around and sold it for $800,000. Exactly what it was worth. He would have no capital gains because when I gave it to him, he would get what's called a stepped up basis. Now, if I had sold it, and I only paid $100,000 for that, and we're assuming this is a commercial property, not my family residence, then I would have to pay capital gain on $700,000 of gain, which would be a substantial amount of money.
That's right. And by giving it to me, you mean passing it on to me?
Passing it on.
At your unfortunate
time of demise. I named you in my trust, you know, to the Kevin Stege Benevolent Society.
Ah, okay. Sounding good right now.
You don't get your hopes up. Better buy a lottery ticket.
Okay.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Yeah, so that's how stepped up basis works. And it's really a huge tax planning tool, if you will, to look at your basis, and as you're getting closer to the time, you know, if you're getting up in your 80s or something like that, you definitely should be looking at your basis. Obviously, if you you know, you're in your 50s, you've got some time, but none of us really know what our final time of demise is, but stepped up basis is a great thing to utilize. Often I see where a client has wanted to generate some cash, and so they'll go out and they'll sell something that has a huge amount of appreciation to maybe pay long-term care facility cost or something. And all of a sudden, you know, a year before somebody's going to pass, they've just generated a huge income tax liability. Sometimes that's unavoidable, but there are ways often to do things, to structure things, maybe look at other options. Maybe borrowing a home equity loan line would be better than recognizing a huge amount of capital gain on something that's greatly appreciated.
Right. I mean, there are so many, and it gets so complex, and each case is individual, is has to be judged on its own facts and values and things like that, and it gets really complicated. But for example, I know that it's not uncommon to have a husband and wife where the husband has all the property, or a wife has all the property, or some combination of that. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, the value of the wealth is primarily held by the husband for whatever reason, or vice versa. And then they go about, you know, doing some estate planning, and, you know, what if the one with the low value, with the high value dies first? Well, that person now has the capital gain situation, whereas if the one with the high value dies first and it goes to the other spouse, it gets stepped up. And if you try to divide those things up, though, if you give something to someone during your lifetime, you don't get that stepped up basis.
That's right.
And so if you give your wife half your assets, and that's some significant amount, she's now got the same basis that you do. So she doesn't get the benefit of the stepped-up basis when you die. So it's oftentimes better to wait. But you can't, there again, the problem with doing that is you can't count on who's going to die first.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's always some flexibility and you can't guess. So you kind of try to hit the middle, the middle of the road somehow and try to decide what's going to work best for everybody.
So with estate planning and trusts and wills and that type of a thing, there's usually two aspects to this. There's what I call the tax tail, and then there's the legal side of things. There's the aspect of how to legally transfer assets and that process, and then there's the tax side. When we talk about a tax estate, that's different than what you would look at for what's in a trust and what's in like a probate estate. So how do trusts and wills and how does that play into this whole thing?
Well, that's a very good segue to one of our topics. Well, you're right. Well, a will and a trust have some similarities. The biggest difference between a will and a trust is that a will comes into effect when you die. And when it comes into effect, then, in order to transfer title to property that's passing by that will, you have to go through the court proceeding called probate. And probate is overseen by the court, takes roughly 6 months to a year, depending on how complex the estate is, and involves the filing of numerous papers in the court, and also paying the bills, paying any taxes that might exist, paying any inheritance taxes that might be a result of the death, and then distributing the property. The trust is like a will substitute. The trust is the same thing, does the same thing, except you transfer your assets to the trust during your lifetime, and it comes into effect during your lifetime. So even if you become incapacitated, the trust is still good and can be administered by your successor trustee and for your benefit. So your assets can be used for your care, however, depending on the structure of the trust. And then when you die, the successor trustee, because you've already transferred these assets to this trust, has the legal authority to turn around and do the same thing that the personal representative would do under the court proceeding without going to court. And that means that it usually takes less time, and it usually means that it is significantly less costly. And I say usually because, like anything else, if there's trouble or too much complexity, whether it's a trust or whether it's a will, it ends up costing money. The things that cost the most money is when the heirs get mad and want to fight with each other. Then it gets really expensive because, you know, as the phrase is, everybody lawyers up. And, about that time, the dollars start draining out of the trust a little bit or out of the estate. And it usually causes some issues with family members and things anyway. So, if you want to avoid battles over trusts and wills, the best thing to do is not make anybody mad. Now, I grant you, that's not always easy to do because there's going to be somebody who's mad no matter what you do. And if you are one of those people who, I often tell my clients this, if you're one of those folks who is blessed with what I call the harmonious family, where all of the kids or all of the heirs or whoever all get along really well, and they would be willing to compromise and do whatever it takes to preserve their relationships as opposed to get the last nickel, you are blessed indeed. So that's my kind of editorial comment on trusts and wills.
Very nice. And, that's where you and I look at estates differently is you have the probate estate created by the will. You have the trust estate that you're administering via the written instructions of the trust. And then when a client comes to me, when I ask for your taxable estate, that includes all of it, every single asset that the decedent had incidents of ownership in, whether partial or full, and we look at that as a whole to determine, are you over the $1 million or under the $1 million?
Well, right, because like a probate estate would not include things like life insurance that has a beneficiary designation. It would not include IRAs that have a beneficiary designation. That would go outside of probate, and indeed that would probably go outside the trust.
Exactly.
And so there's a misunderstanding there. a lot of people, you know, I've always heard it said, here, you can clear this up for us. A lot of people think that life insurance proceeds are tax-free. So what's the scoop on that?
Income tax-free, yes. They are subject to estate or inheritance taxes, if you will. If you're under the $1 million with that included in, then yes, they will be passed through completely tax-free. If you otherwise, they are added into the taxable estate, and you may have to, the estate may have to pay some inheritance taxes. One thing that we do to help simplify this whole process is when a person passes away with some probate assets and with a living trust that's now become irrevocable after they've passed away, and you have trust assets, right at that moment, you have two income tax returns that are required to be filed, one for the estate, one for the trust. But we can make an election to combine that under one tax return. A trust has to file under a calendar year, where an estate can file under a fiscal year, which gives us a huge amount of flexibility and avoid extra tax returns. And so when we make that election, it simplifies things quite significantly. And you can imagine, if we're trying to keep track of assets in one under one tax return, assets in another, that's a real mell of a hess, as my aunt used to say.
I like it. And that's why, you know, I know that there are a number of lawyers who do their own, you know, tax returns. I just think it's a lot easier to let you folks do it, because you have the software and keep up on the most recent techniques that are used for that. Whereas we can try to do that as lawyers, but and certainly some do it very, very well. But in the long run, I think, for at least for my clients, it's been more economical to have their own tax professional do that part of it. And we, the lawyers, will do the administration part of it as much as is necessary. And so, anyway, those are kinds of things that we've been talking about. I think we're going to take a little quick break, and then we're going to come back, and we'll continue this discussion. For those of you who have questions about probate, trusts, wills, estates, taxes, please give us a call, 503-417-7626. We'll be back in a few minutes. This is Investing Simplified.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue, near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. 7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepsen and Kevin Stege. Chuck Price is out learning more and more about the investing world, and we'll be back next week. We've been talking about wills and trusts and a whole lot of other subjects, and we do like to have this as an interactive show, and that means you have to call. We can't call you. And if you want to do that, it's 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We would love to talk to you, and if you have comments or if you have subjects that you'd like us to discuss, even if you don't have a specific question in mind, or if you just want to, you know, take issue with us or try to stump us with something, that's fine too. We welcome any call. And if you're sitting around having your last cup of coffee, it's pretty painless. You don't even have to tell us, you know, who you are. You can just, you know, you can make up a name if you want. So, we'll gladly do our best to try to provide you with some information that's at least useful or if not entertaining to you. Anyway, we were talking about wills and trusts, and Kevin and I both do a lot of work with small businesses. And small businesses generally take about three different forms. One is a sole proprietorship. That means I own my business. That's it. Number two, a partnership. And that's where Kevin and I own the business, but we don't have anything in place other than Kevin and I work together and we share the profits. That's called a partnership. And then three is what's called a corporation. And in that case, what we do is we buy shares in the corporation by putting money into it. That's capitalizing the corporation. And then we have a certain number of shares. So I'm like a 10% owner and Kevin's a 90% owner. That means he gets to run the show pretty much. And that's how that one works. And then we have what are called limited liability companies, which are essentially the same kind of thing, except you buy your membership interest. And it's kind of like a partnership without shares, but it's also like a corporation without shares. But in the meantime, we've got a caller, Marshall, on a question on trust. Good morning, Marshall.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah, would you explain about the Trust A and Trust B, where you divide your assets so it's under $1 million?
Sure. What you're describing, Trust A and Trust B, is probably one of the most common forms of tax-saving planning. And it generally applies to a husband and wife, and it applies where their estate exceeds the taxable amount. So let's say for Oregon purposes, the estate is $2 million, and the husband dies, and at that point, what would happen generally, I mean, this is in real kind of general terms, the B trust would be funded with that $1 million, and the A trust would be for the wife. The wife could do, if the husband dies first, the wife could use the A trust basically any way she wanted to, do anything she wanted with it. The B trust, she would have all of the income, and she would be able to take whatever she needed for her health, education, welfare, support, and maintenance. But the B trust would become irrevocable, and she couldn't change it. However, the advantage to that is that the $1 million that you just put in that B trust, when the wife dies, is absolutely tax-free. And the reason for that is because it was already taxed, theoretically. Because what you would do is you would file a tax return when the husband dies and would list the B trust, but because it was under the exemption amount, the $1 million, it wouldn't be taxed, but it was theoretically taxed because you filed a tax return. And now, here's the good part. If that B trust had assets that appreciated, say it was filled with, I don't know, what is appreciating nowadays? Beanie Babies. And if it appreciated so, like, in another 5 years, it was now worth $5 million. Now, the interesting thing there is that when wife dies, that $5 million in the B trust goes to whoever it's supposed to go to, tax-free. And now there is income tax on the income of the trust, but that gets passed through to the wife, so she's got to pay it just like, you know, she would anyway. But the appreciation gets a do not go to jail card. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yes, it does.
It's not quite that simple, but that's basically the way it works. And, you know, it depends a lot on the numbers and sometimes the assets that and the methodology for how you fund the trust is different depending on how the trust is structured. And it gets a little more complicated than that, but really almost all husband and wife, estate planning, documents end up doing something that results in at least the possibility of an AB type trust. The lawyers have made a good living calling them different things. The A trust has often been called the survivor's trust.
Yes.
It may have been called the loving trust. It may have been called the spousal trust or the marital trust. You can go to the B side, and it might have been called the disclaimer trust or the Q-tip trust or the credit shelter trust or the exemption trust or any number of other things. But AB works pretty good, and most of us know what AB is about. And those different names tend to denote different ways of funding the B trust is really what they end up doing. But, you know, it gets pretty darn confusing. And, you know, most of the clients that I work with, sometimes they walk out of there and go, you know, every time I come to your office, I get a headache. And I try to say, no, that's not, see, just look back to the B trust. This is the good trust for you. So hopefully that answers your question. Anything else we can help you with?
Yes. My last page of my trust is kind of disappeared someplace, and it has it makes up the trust. It says it is a trust. Is that disappeared now? What do I do about something like that?
Okay, the last page, is that with the signature page that you're?
Yes.
Ooh. Okay. Well, and you want to just preserve it the way it is? Is that what you want to do?
Yes.
Here's the way I would do that. I would have I'd have your lawyer do this. I would have your lawyer do what we would call a restatement of the trust. And it would be like a one-page paper, and the way I would do it would be you know, I, Marshall, hereby, you know, declare that I lost the last page of my trust and I want it to be restated, and it's still in force, and all of the assets that are in it are still in it. And by my signature, this, you know, and unless I've changed it some other way, it remains just exactly the same way it was, and I'm re-executing it here at the bottom of this page. And the trust without the last page is attached as Exhibit A. And then you would execute it in the same manner that you did the original trust. So if it was notarized in the first place or if you had witnesses in the first place, do it the same way. You're in business.
Okay.
So that sounds real simple, but and it is. It's really just that's one of the good things about trusts. They're a little easier to. And I don't know how yours was executed. That usually they're not executed in the same way that wills are, although they can be. So you have to kind of remember how it looked. So and even if not, if you wanted to be completely safe and you couldn't remember whether it was notarized or whether it was, which it doesn't necessarily have to be, but if it or it was whether it was witnessed, do both and call it good. You know, I mean, you can always you can't go wrong with overkill. So. So either way, though, the specific language is not magic formula. Probably be a little bit more eloquent than I described, but it would be essentially saying that. So those are kind of, you know, that's essentially what it would be saying is, oops, I lost my, you know, last page. I really didn't want to terminate the trust. The trust still exists, and by signing this, I hereby ratify and confirm all of the provisions of the original trust in this here restatement. So. That's how it works.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Well, thanks for calling, Marshall. Appreciate it very much.
You're right.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Well, you're a wealth of knowledge today.
Well, it's a knowledge trust.
This is very good stuff.
So,
all these little things that make a difference, very, very good, very good information. Thanks for calling.
You know, it's very interesting. I actually have one of those going on right now where they lost the trust, but they got a copy. Well, we just restated it. You know, I mean, it worked out. So, yeah.
Very good.
Good thing.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we were going to be talking about corporations and limited liability companies and all that stuff. So, again, we have this sort of different piece of the pie as to how we look at it. From the lawyer standpoint, whether we set up a corporation or a limited liability company has to do with the documents that form the corporation and getting it registered with the state of Oregon or wherever you're registering this thing, and making sure that those documents are in play. And usually that's our piece of the pie, whereas the tax pie is significantly different. And so I'm going to turn that over to you, and you can tell us a little bit about how they vary, because we try to give advice on that, and but if it's something I don't know, I usually call you.
Well, typically, when a person is forming a new business, we look at the tax aspects of what the business is, what sort of income they're going to be generating, whether it's capital gains, whether it's self-employment income, that type of a thing. Then we refer them to you for the legal setup, or, you know, in some cases they can do it themselves. But I understand that we've got another call.
Well, yeah, I guess we're having a trouble getting away from these trusts today. So
excellent.
I guess David's on the line. David, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, I got a question about trust and picking trustees. I'm looking for an independent trustee, and I'm finding everything from Larry's Transmission Repair and Trustee Services to other private trustees that only do that. I've also found that banks do it. They have a trust department that will manage trusts. Do you know anything about that?
I do. In fact, you know, I used the transmission guy the other day, and that didn't work out real well. No, I'm kidding. I didn't. Yes, there are different types of trustees. Banks, it used to be the banks did a lot of this, and it kind of varies from bank to bank. Most banks will not handle trusts. The way banks want to handle trusts, quite frankly, is they want to manage the money. And they don't really like to manage real estate. They like to manage money. So if you have a big, you know, cash-rich trust, they like to manage that, and then they'll distribute from the trust to the trust, you know, through the to the beneficiaries in accordance with the trust. They usually will charge a fee, which usually is based on a percentage of the amount of the money in the trust on an annual basis. So if it's $1 million and it's 1%, you know, that's whatever that is. It's a lot. And so that's that. And so a lot of times they won't take even a small trust. Then you have, and some of the smaller banks will, and then you have companies that, or individuals that are professional trustees, and they often are what we call professional fiduciaries, which means generally that they will, also be, guardians and conservators for people. And they usually have insurance, and they're usually bonded or need to be bonded. You would probably want them to, meaning that if they abscond with the money, the insurance company pays it back. And the way that they work is various forms. The most common, I think, is that they bill their work on an hourly basis, depending on what that work is. So if it's really kind of professional work, they'll bill more of a professional rate. If it's kind of just record keeping or you know, routine administrative stuff or errand running or whatever it might be, then it'll be billed at different rates. And they'll have that set forth in some kind of an agreement. And that depends. And now those folks will also engage people that are like caseworkers who might need to assess the care and oversee that. They might even hire caregivers, and you know they'll do all of that kind of administration stuff as well as you know just the manage the money thing. So that's how those two things work. Like I said, there are companies that do that, professional fiduciary companies. And then there are also individuals who serve as individual trustees or individual conservators, or fiduciaries. Some are good, some are not as good. And, I've had the one good thing about the big guys, I guess you might say, the people who do it day in and day out and have multiple conservators and stuff is that they really know the ropes. They're pretty efficient at doing what they do. Some people think that they're extraordinarily expensive, but I have seen individual trustees, you know, who maybe aren't quite as efficient end up, you know, being fairly competitive with the people who do. And then I've seen some trustees who do it kind of on a relatively economical basis. But by and large, you want to make sure that they're, you know, trustworthy people, and that they're not just, like you say, they're not Larry's transmission guy deciding that trust work is what he wants to do. So does that answer your kind of questions?
Yeah. There's a lot out there, and that's kind of what I'm getting is the banks really don't handle anything other than money. But this was the first I found out about it yesterday.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. I mean, there are some trust departments. I mean, if you were going to give them, you know, an $8 million trust fund, and part of the deal was that they had to take care of, you know, the beneficiary for the rest of their life, they'd do it for you. They'll figure it out. I mean, it might cost you, but they'll do it. On the other hand, if you've got a $200,000 estate, they're probably not going to do it at all. They probably won't even do the money part under those circumstances. And usually, those are the ones, you know, unfortunately, those are the ones that are most difficult to do, because you've got to be very mindful of making the money last long enough to, you know, longer than you know, mom does or dad does or the kid does. So.
Yeah. Okay, great. It just makes it more complicated now.
All right, I'm afraid it is. You could ask your lawyer for some recommendations. I don't really want to do that on the air, but you can call me and I can give you some of the big guys and some of the little guys and some that I've worked with. And I think with good success in some. The problem is that they're always going to be more expensive than an individual trustee who is appointed by the. You know, but that's not always good either. The individual trustee who doesn't have to be bonded and who isn't a neutral, really, who is a person who is, you know, part of the family or whatever it is, sometimes that doesn't work out, and that can end up costing an awful lot of money too. So, you know, it's just the cheapest way to do it is to have a real trustworthy family member. The most expensive way to do it is to have a very untrustworthy family member. So, it kind of goes either way. So, and when you have the latter, you usually end up with the professional trustee, and nobody likes spending the money because we want, you know, mom or dad to be able to, you know, live out their days in peace, and relative prosperity, at least not, you know, going into bankruptcy or going into Medicaid. But unfortunately, that doesn't always, you know, balance out quite as well as we'd like.
I think it's a situation that you need to spend some time on and vet your individuals or your companies that you're going to do, because it's I think it really is, if you're not the trustee of your own trust, or if your spouse isn't, or your trusted child or family member, once you go outside of that circle of immediate family that has good relationships, I think it's really important to look at who you're going to be having do it. I think there's some relative safety with the larger companies that would, you know what you're getting. They're insured, they're bonded, they're huge companies. There's some safety in terms of mismanagement, probably, although I'm sure you've seen your case where cases where that's not always the case. But that said, that may not always be the best place to go. And there are, you know, a trusted attorney is a very good place to go, or a CPA. You know, we're trustees for a number of clients. You know, if there's a someone you've worked with for 20 years, 30 years, that's not a bad place to go. But then, you know, there's all sorts of levels in between.
Absolutely. So, David, I hope that answers your question.
I think he's off the air now.
Goodbye, so. David. Thanks.
Thanks for calling very much.
So anyway, well, we're running up against the end of our show, but we're not done yet, quite. We're going to go back to corporations. You were going to talk about corporations and the tax aspect of
it. Yeah, just a little bit on that. Probably one of the best ways to go when you are setting up your business, you know, the legal aspect is you want to have some limited liability. If you've got a really simple business, no problem being a sole proprietor. If you don't have much exposure, you know, you pay the most taxes probably because you're paying self-employment tax, so on and so forth, but it's very simple. and you can just move forward with that. But if you've got a little bit of liability exposure based on the nature of your business, then it's very advisable to set up a corporation or an LLC for legal liability limitation. And then from that point, especially if it's an LLC, we've got a lot of flexibility to determine how you're going to be taxed.
You know, the interesting thing, limited liability just means this. It means that if the company gets sued, that your personal assets are not vulnerable to the creditors. You lose whatever's in the company, but you don't lose your house and your car and your, you know, whatever.
That's right.
So that's what limited liability is about. Preserving that limited liability is a function of how you manage your corporation and how it's set up. So you know, you want to start out right before you go forward, because it's rare that the corporation or the limited liability company has a creditor that does what we call piercing the corporate veil. I like that. Doesn't that sound really exotic? Anyway, because it doesn't happen very often, and it requires some sort of malfeasance on the part of the shareholder or the owner. But it does happen, and the best way to avoid that is to have it done right in the first place.
Operate the business as a true business. Don't commingle your assets in the business. Don't use the corporate or the LLC account as your piggy bank. Make proper distributions. Document those things. The drawback to a corporation legally is probably all of the red tape that needs to go on.
Yeah, the corporation requires a lot more paperwork.
Yeah.
Whereas the limited liability company, especially if you're small, especially if it's like a single member LLC or a, you know, husband and wife LLC, relatively minimal. Although generally I would recommend a little bit more than the minimum, just, you know, for a variety of reasons, but mostly because it makes you look more like a business.
That's true. That's true. So when somebody comes to us and we've got an LLC that we're thinking about setting up, We determine first of all, is it going to be a single member or a multi-member? If it's single, you can be taxed as a sole proprietorship. In fact, you probably will be. Other than that, I guess we've run up to the end of it.
We have. You've been listening to Investing Simplified, and this is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I can be reached at 503-255-8795 or at warrenallen.com. And Kevin, your contact information?
We're at bakercolson.com. Located at 2414 Northeast Division, and you can reach me at 503-666-5569, and we will pick this up next week.
Absolutely. Enjoy the weekend. The weather's beautiful. Come on down, watch the marathon. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group. Well.